Welcome, everyone, to this, the second of our so-called discussion debate panels. Our topic is the provisioning of collaboration tools for teaching and learning. Now, collaboration has emerged as a core pedagogical technique or engagement reflecting larger cultural shifts. The new emphasis on collaboration has been encouraged by insight into how we learn, but also by the burgeoning set of collaboration apps and applications. And I think we'd all agree that these developments present new and promising directions. Yet it poses challenges as well. Can the IT organization ever hope to support such a diversity? Now, in the past, IT has been able to succeed to a degree by achieving some degree of conformity around a set of tools and running those tools themselves. But today, given not only the diversity of the tool options, but also the in-the-cloud providers, what then is IT's role today as the provisioner of the academic technological landscape? And on the flip side, what should faculty and student expectations be? How much help and support should they expect? Are the tools simple enough that they don't need support? In short, should faculty expectations, in light of shrinking resources, be reset? Now, I can think of no better set of colleagues with which to discuss this point than the three I have sitting next to me. Let me introduce them now. Jim Davis is Vice Provost for IT and Chief Academic Technology Officer at UCLA. This is a new role with broader responsibilities focused on UCLA's academic research and education mission, but also building on his past position as Associate Vice Chancellor and CIO. Jim has responsibilities for the Institute for Digital Research and Education, the Institute for Informatics, and UCLA's Institutional Educational Technology. Sally Jackson is Professor of Communication and Co-Director of the Center for People and Infrastructures at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Previously, she served as Chief Information Officer at Illinois, and before that, at the University of Arizona. Sally received her PhD from Illinois in 1980. Finally, Michael Wesch is Associate Professor of Cultural Anthropology at Kansas State University, studying the effects of social media and digital technology on global society. Mike has won several major awards for his work, including a Wired Magazine Rave Award, the John Culkin Award for Outstanding Practice in Media Ecology, and was recently named an Emerging Explorer by National Geographic. So welcome to our three colleagues. So how we're going to proceed is that I've asked each of our three panelists to give an opening 10-minute statement offering their reflections on how to come at this conundrum, and then we'll be open for debate and questions. So without further ado, we'll be going in alphabetical order. So Jim, please begin.
All right, thanks, Malcolm. And I apologize to people over here. It's a little hard to turn my neck, so I'll do my best. So first of all, with the name Jim Davis, I lost the alphabetical war. I was on a panel last week, and there was eight of us, and I lost that war as well, so I get to go first. But the advantage is I get to say Happy Valentine's Day to everyone. And I can also turn to Malcolm. If we run over a little bit, Malcolm's not panicked yet, as will happen later. But I don't intend to go over. What I'd like to do is just kind of set my remarks with just a little bit of a thinking, the thinking that we're doing at UCLA. And let me set the stage a little bit with a couple of positioning sorts of things, and then I'll give you a couple of specifics just to illustrate. The first thing is, Malcolm mentioned this role, Chief Academic Technology Officer, which is a new role, and that's an interesting experiment in its own right. What it is intended to do is to give me or this position more program responsibility. So when we talk about research and education, I have more program responsibility as opposed to infrastructure or IT responsibility, but there's a crossover. And just to illustrate a couple other components of this, I still do have responsibility for policy for the campus. I do have responsibility for IT planning. I have responsibility for governance. But interestingly, I was able to give up security, actually in favor of privacy. So security someplace else, and I'm focusing my attention on privacy. What this has allowed me to do is to think about education, and I guess I get my engineering hat on in a way, because I think about it as systems. So my responsibility on the educational side is really thinking about technology systems, learning systems, policy systems, financial systems, service systems, infrastructure systems, and how they all actually come together to make up the learning environment for the campus. And one of the things I like to say is my colleague at Northwestern, Julio Otino, has actually been instrumental in defining the difference between complicated and complex. So a Boeing 787 is complicated, weather is complex, and from my perspective, education is complex. We don't know where it's going sometimes. So with that, just a couple of backdrop comments. The first is I've attended a lot of CIO meetings recently, and one of the things I've noticed is that the conversations around educational technology have been sounding more and more alike. And when I look at my colleagues and look at the other campuses, from a technology standpoint to a first approximation, we're all pretty much deploying the same technology. We're all have access to the same kinds of technologies. So this has kind of brokered this discussion or prompted the discussion about what are the differences. And we've been thinking a lot about what are the differences with our campuses. And when I visit different campuses, I know there are dramatic differences. There are there's various features, there's various things that are promoted, there's various environment, various talents, skills, state settings, different settings that really do make up a different way that the campus has come to the students as well as the students that come to that campus. So we've got this kind of discussion going, which is how does the educational technology or the technology actually reflect the features we want to promote from a UCLA standpoint. This was actually in very stark contrast for me. I actually had the honor, I think is probably as good a word as any, to be involved in the launch of the Technology Enhanced Learning and Research Initiative at Ohio State. And then at UCLA, we launched what we call the Common Collaboration Learning Environment. And they're dramatically different in terms of the technologies, how they're applied, what's emphasized, and so forth. So this has actually prompted us down this path of just simply what's pushed from the center and what's pulled from the campus. And we've been putting a lot of programs in place in the category of pull from the campus so that we are reflecting these features and the capabilities of the campus in a very direct way. So it's kind of like let chaos come forward, if you will. So I'd like to talk about a couple of examples of where we have done this, and it's become very interesting around collaboration tools. And by the way, our definition of collaboration tools is anything that people are using to collaborate, so we've not gotten into a precise definition whatsoever. But a couple of examples. Again, our learning management system, which is Moodle-based, is housed or hosted in an environment which we call Common Collaboration Learning Environment. And one of the things we did when we put that together is we put together about $200,000 a year for what we call innovation grants. And rather than sinking that money into central staff, what we did was put that into the grants and basically have an annual RFP in which that money goes out and the various academic units apply for those. And generally speaking, what happens there is that different needs that are emerging in a particular unit and that they think can apply to the campus is brought forward as a grant. It goes to a competition. And this has actually produced a great deal of functionality in our CCLE environment. Another example is in our mobility apps. One of the things we expressly did was design the architecture so that it's very light, very standards-based, and it starts following the model of our ever-present app store. But what we've been trying to do is encourage the build-out of these apps by the staff, the departments, and the students. And at the present time, this has actually been pretty successful for us in that we have about 20 different departments that are actually funding and building out the particular apps from an administrative or an environment standpoint. And we've also started up a number of student contests that are bringing forward remarkably interesting apps from the students themselves. So on the campus, we're getting the usual through this process, news, events, directory, study lists, grades, classmates, these sorts of things. But from the students, it's actually been very, very interesting. And we just completed a contest. And just an example of some of the entries, the winner was one called Superfoods. And this was an application which someone puts together nutritional information around particular foods so that people know that they're eating well. One of the runner-ups was what we call Hunger Hotspots, and it was about all of the different donut sales or food sales for fundraisers so that those always could be located. And the third one was freebies. Where can you find a free movie? Where can you find a free lecture? Any of these kinds of things. And those are not so much in the collaboration tools arena, but they provided some pretty interesting insight to how the students are thinking about these kinds of applications. The last one I wanted to talk about and just dwell on just for a few minutes is we completed an IT plan, which we call IT 2020, back in 2009. And this was a campus-wide sort of usual initiative, but we spent quite a bit of time about how technology would be, how would be deployed. And one of the concepts that came out of that plan from the campus was a notion of digital citizen. And the notion of digital citizen actually, you know, we kind of have a lot of words around it, but it fundamentally comes down to two parts. One is how can you bring technology to each individual so that they are aware enough and have access to it so that they can pursue their particular individual objectives in the best, most innovative way possible. But that's one. The other premise was, how can that particular individual give back to the community? So there's a give back, there's an aspect of responsibility to the community. And one of the things we've been doing is playing out that concept in a number of different ways. I want to give you a few examples of these. And these are ways that are now starting to bring these collaboration tools out and sorting them out for us as a campus. The first one is called FACTech, Faculty Technology. And I was mentioning this morning, but basically what this is IT speed dating for faculty. And what we do is we set up with a department, with a faculty sponsor and an IT staff person, six tables in the department. Each one has a selected technology, and faculty rotate from table to table, spending only 5 to 10 minutes with each of the technologies. Now, I got to admit, when I first heard about this, I thought this was crazy. This can't work. It's stupid. But I have come to find, and I have pulled back those words, because the faculty love it. And essentially, you know, the kinds of examples that are around, we have a list of about 20 of these tools that appear in the different departments, but these are things like Turnitin, Dropbox, Evernote, lynda.com, RCCLE, and so forth. But again, this has been remarkably useful in getting the faculty involved with these technologies, but also hearing from the faculty about what they're interested in. A second one that's been really interesting is we call it First Fridays. And this is where our emeriti staff and faculty come together. And one of the things we did is we brought an IT group together to help them with their technology. And so this is the usual thing. These are people that are usually, starting to use the word vintage, I guess that works, I'm in that category too. But these are people that really don't know how to use a camera, a digital camera, may want to send something to a grandchild, really don't know how to use a smartphone, and so forth. We brought our IT staff together with these folks, and they love this. And one of the things this has done is it generated an enormous amount of community spirit on the campus between our IT staff and our emeriti staff and faculty. A third one, I'll stop here, we call it Pizza and Complaints. And the name was given by our student affairs organization. But essentially, this is where we bring students together with basically administrative IT people that don't normally come together. So it's a form of focus group, but the setup is different. What we do is we meet with the administrative IT folks and we say, you are not allowed to talk, you can only listen, and you can't defend what you're doing. And the whole session then goes forward with the students talking about how they're experiencing technology on the campus. But what this has produced is a remarkable set of student needs and understanding about the student, and has produced a number of these collaboration tools. So things like syllabus preview, academic course listings, and a variety of things have sorted out through this kind of process. And one of the things I wanted to mention with this digital citizen, if you think about these three, you know, where do we get the capacity to do these? And this is where we've been bringing the IT staff together in a community setting. And one of the it's almost like the secret sauce. You have to kind of get it just right. But what we have found is an extremely interesting mixture, which is the IT staff have been hunkered down and isolated on the campus and really do want to do something for the community. They also are very interested in the professional networking in a broader way across the campus, and their supervisors are actually seeing huge benefit in them learning about all these different tools around the campus and bringing them into their operations. So if you bring all those together, there's actually this significant number of IT staff that are kind of coming out of all these different shops on the campus and participating in these community exercises, and this together has produced, you know, roughly about, at any given time, 100 faculty giving up about 2 or 3 hours a week. So if you think about it, that's an enormous amount of effort going in that you would never achieve with regular kinds of classes. And so this whole power of the community piece and keeping it very informal, keeping it very light, has actually proved to be an extremely good way for us to sort out these collaboration tools. So let me kind of stop there. What I'm ultimately positioning is a lot of effort we've been doing in this push and pull category, drawing upon the community, drawing upon a number of different ways in which you put checks and balances in that as a result of the community or contests or RFPs that sort through these particular applications. And what we're finding is that this has been a pretty good way of sorting these out and keeping them managed from a cost and a usefulness standpoint. And then my closing remark will be, I haven't mentioned governance at all, but the notion and the robustness of an IT governance to keep this all intact is actually extremely important, and that's one other ingredient that keeps this going. So I hope that gives you a position of processes and the way we've been thinking about this as a campus. And I'll defer very, very quickly to Mike and Malcolm and Sally if there's anything having to do with the quality or how these particular tools play out in the classroom in an effectiveness or outcomes manner. These are all exercises in how the community brings these forward.
Jim, thank you very, very much.
I now turn to Sally Jackson. Sally, please begin.
Thanks, Malcolm. Do my best to look around this thing. Digitization and ubiquitous connections are still relatively new to us, and we're still seeing how the effects on work and civic life are going to unfold. But what should already be very clear to us by now is that we need to start training graduates for a different kind of work. Specifically, many people have commented that 21st century work is requiring a much higher degree of readiness for collaboration across industries, across professions. People are being expected to form teams and to perform work that cuts across distance, that cuts across organizational boundaries, that may involve multiple subject matters, that may cut across cultures as well. The best example that comes to mind is the way the rise of interprofessional preparation and interdisciplinary practice teams are ascending in importance in the health professions. When we say that 21st century work is going to require new competencies, that means that for educators, we need to think in terms of new learner outcomes. And I've tipped my hand on one of the learner outcomes I think we need to be paying more attention to. I'm just going to call it collaboration readiness because I don't have another term for it yet. But I mean not only the ability to work well in a team, but all the other things that go into that. Locating the understanding when a task requires collaboration, understanding what kinds of expertise it requires, knowing how to recruit a team, how to keep work coordinated, and so on. Another accompanying competence that people need for 21st century work is adeptness at the choice and use of communication technologies. This is clearly an aspect of digital literacy, but it goes well beyond the sorts of things that have definitely by now come to the front burner as we think about digital literacy and preparing digitally literate graduates. It goes well beyond information retrieval and information retrieval tools and has to do with sophistication in people's understanding of how communication technology platforms shape social behavior. So in my mind, collaboration readiness and this special sense of digital literacy are on a par with 20th century learner outcomes like critical thinking and disciplined thought and expression. And we need to treat them with equal seriousness, treating them as something that rises above the design of individual courses and goes to the design of the curriculum and the whole fabric of a college education. So before we can even ask how to provide collaboration support for students, we need to consider what will make them ready for collaboration as graduates. And I'm going to argue that we should be doing some things that we've been actively avoiding for at least the past 10 years. It's not just that we haven't been doing them, we've been actively avoiding them. And the first of these things is to expose students to many different collaboration environments and provide them many opportunities to enter new environments and bring themselves to a level of competence sufficient for the task at hand. This flies in the face of conventional wisdom on our campuses that says that students want and demand a consistent learning environment. They want to see the consistent interface, and they don't want to waste time in the learning curve of trying to come up to competence in a new tool. Well, they need to. They may not want to, but they need to. And I do not believe that students will regard it as a waste of time if we move them onto tools that they still might be able to use after they graduate, instead of asking them to invest in tools that are only used in school. Okay, I've had an intuition that this is harmful for students for many years, but my intuition has gotten empirical support lately in research that looks at what happens when people become over-standardized on a coordination platform or any other communication tool. One recent study of interagency disaster response teams looked at how a set of agencies, each of which had fully standardized on their own collaboration platform, failed to be able to engage with one another at just the moment when it was important for them to be able to cross agency lines and form teams to bring together many different kinds of expertise. They had no practice in ad hoc organization outside their standardized platform. We don't want that for our students. We don't want that for our graduates. So we need to expose them to many different collaboration environments and provide them extensive practice in entering new environments, getting oriented, and equipping themselves to behave competently there, just like we do for a wide range of other kinds of experience. Further, we need to give them opportunities to reflect on technology design and on what technology itself does to social practice. Technology design has always does something to the structure of work and to how relationships are configured. They're not neutral. When students only know one way of doing things, they begin to think that that is part of the activity itself and not something that has been designed around the activity. They start to see it as the natural environment and not the built environment that it is. Exposing students to multiple technology platforms allows them to separate the design of a particular system from the underlying practice that the system is enabling. So we need to give them opportunities to reflect on design and think about it. And what will follow from that almost necessarily is cultivation of taste and judgment in choice of technologies. As people mature in their careers and become managers and leaders, it becomes especially important that they know how to do all of the tasks that are involved in bringing together collaborative groups to solve problems. And that means not only choosing people with whom to team, but also choosing all of the enablements that are going to bring the project to its conclusion. Okay, people in IT know that standards are good. But what I'm saying today is that standardized tools are a hindrance to any effort to train students to become collaboration ready and digitally literate. All the tools that people use will benefit from being standards compliant in that general sense. But standardizing on a platform is a hindrance to the outcomes that we'd like to achieve. Faculty should be able to teach students what it means to collaborate in specific fields, free to choose whatever tools are appropriate for that. And students in their collaboration should not be assigned to work within supported platforms, but should be able to choose whatever tools they want for self-organization. And although what I've said so far simply sounds idealistic, I believe that it can be made realistic. how to make this manageable is, of course, the key question. And I hope that our discussion for the remainder of the hour will bring us back to these topics. But I want to bring up just two things that I think are critically important if what we want to do is get away from the kinds of strategies that will prevent us from making people collaboration ready and digitally literate. The first thing we need to do is give up campus scale services. And I'm being radical on purpose here. But campus scale is neither local enough to allow us to tailor platforms to subject matter, and it's not global enough to provide the skills that a student needs to be able to collaborate with anybody that they might encounter in their later working life. I can't resist saying that campus scale is the sour spot between the local and the global. And the second thing I think we need to do is we need to consciously adopt a tool approach that people are calling meta-management. This is a concept that comes out of theorizing on virtual organizations, and it has to do with the things that we do to try to organize assets that we do not control. For the case of higher education, the best example that I can come up with is a set of policies and procedures that were developed by my colleague, Mike Korn, at Illinois. He wanted faculty to be able to make their own choices, their own adoption and acquisition decisions for services procured from the cloud. And so what he did is he developed tools that allowed them to thoughtfully assess risk and execute contracts on their own authority, and if they had discretionary funds, to execute purchases on their own authority for things like Second Life or other things of comparable sort. All right. Whether this can be affordable or not is an empirical question. We have not yet tried this, but I think we should. I'm convinced that if we manage to make this affordable, it'll be better.
Sally, thank you very much. Michael, please go ahead.
So this is great. I think I can jump on and maybe give a few examples of some of the things you guys have discussed. Can I get the projector going here? I want to show you guys a survey that I did that maybe will bring some light to some of the things that we've been talking about, especially the digital literacy piece of this. So I teach these big classes, 200 to 400 students. I asked them real simple sort of raise your hand type of thing. I asked them whether or not they could describe the following concepts to the person sitting next to them. The idea, so fair use, about five hands went up, 5 out of 200. You know, that's terrible. DMCA, again, 5 out of 200. Net neutrality, less than 10. HTML5, less than 10. And then you go on and you ask things like, have you ever used a wiki? And you'd be amazed, you know, less than 10% of the students had ever used a wiki. So we talk a lot about digital natives and them being digitally literate, but in fact, they're not necessarily using these tools in very effective ways. PageRank, again, less than 10 out of 200, really felt like they could explain what PageRank is. And now you think about the implications of this. You know, if you look at how Google works, for example, I mentioned to them that Google follows 57 signals that allow them to do their search engines, including things like they're monitoring where you are, what you're using, what you're doing, what you might do, who you are, in other words, you, right? These 57 signals so that when I search Google, I get different results than when you search Google. And that has really important implications for finding information these days. And then I show them this. This is a screenshot from my own Facebook. And if you look over to the right there, you might see a little ad that says 36 and balding. And isn't that amazing? I am 36 and balding. like the things that they know. Now, like Sally said, though, this is just the beginning. This sort of sophistication of understanding how this information environment works is really just the beginning, because we're really talking about much larger pieces. So, again, on the information piece, this is what a normal Yahoo page would look like on September 20th, 2011. This is what it looked like for me. That's because Yahoo has 100 different front pages, and they show you one based on who you are. That's even if you're not logged in. It's just simply checking your cache and giving you what they think that you might want to see. But like Sally said, it's not just about this information environment and how to find stuff, it's really about collaboration and working together in new ways. And that's what I'm most concerned about, is that our students are so collaboration non-literate. And so in my classes, again, I sort of had to go rogue. I felt like our LMS wasn't providing me the things that I could, that I needed. So I started going outside that system. And instead of having a syllabus, I created a research schedule. And you can see I put it up on a wiki. And by being up on a wiki, that means anybody can edit it. And then we started using a bunch of other tools. And we thought, well, we need to centralize these. So we went to NetVibes. And all these are free tools that we're using. This is netvibes.com. We're just drawing the feed from the changes on the wiki into NetVibes so that people can see those. On the left-hand side, we got another feed for a student blog post. Students can blog from anywhere, and then we pipe them. We use a Yahoo Pipe, another free service, to bring all those feeds together into that single screen there on the left. Then on the right, I'll show you some of these blogs real quick so you can click through the blogs, see these different things. This one's particularly interesting. It shows, I think, something Sally's mentioning about scale. You know, this is a global scale technology. This isn't campus scale. And that means that students who are blogging in their literature review, for example, suddenly get responses from the people in the literature review. So, you know, scholars from, this is one from Columbia who was mentioned, chimes in and says, oh, and you should also pay attention to this, this, and this. So it's that beautiful kind of collaboration beyond the walls kind of thing. Then on the right, we've got our links that we're sharing together. We use Digo, which allows people to highlight things. They hit the bookmark button, and then they can add tags, highlight whatever they want to, add sticky notes, and then these conversations emerge right on the page. All of this is the type of technology that would be really difficult to create on campus with your own developers. But by harnessing all of the creativity that's happening out there on the web, we can do some pretty amazing things. And all of that's being brought into this single page as well. And this is a little messy, like this version of it, but I want to show you Jim Groom's version of this. This is DS-106 at Mary Washington. He pays a little bit of money for this. He pays $6 a month, and he paid $50 for the theme to make this thing look pretty. But this is really cheap overall. And what he's done is virtually the same thing I've done. He's got this blog, but in fact what he's doing is he's pulling student blogs into a single feed that you can see on this main blog. They do other really neat things, like they have daily assignments called the Daily Create. These are actually created by students. It's all automated. Students create an assignment. It's real simple things like take a photo of food being served or eaten in an unconventional way. They post their pictures. Now, this isn't really sophisticated collaboration. Here you see another one, record a video of yourself telling a joke. But what you see is that this allows people to have that sort of the beginnings of collaboration. They're sharing and they're creating community, and then that creates the groundwork for more sophisticated collaboration down the road. So there's quite beautiful things that are here. And of course, this again scales very broadly. So you can go anywhere on the web and tag anything DS-106, which is the title of the class, and it comes into a central feed that everybody else sees. And people from all over the world have joined in the class, whether they're students or not. So that's another interesting little way to be out there in the world collaborating. Now, here's another one. Once you start doing this and you start thinking about how you can use these tools, there's all sorts of new possibilities for collaboration emerge, new ways to think about your course. So, for example, in the first 2 weeks of my classes, I used to assign key readings. And now, instead, what we do is we all get together, we decide, we think about what the core things we want to learn are. We think about what the core topic is, and then the students go to the library and they read anything and everything they want to about that topic. And then they go on something like Etherpad or Google Docs, and they summarize what they're reading. So if I have 15 students in a class, this is an actual real example, 15 students in the class, and we decided we were going to study anonymity online. Okay, so that week, all the readings are about anonymity online, but I don't assign them. They go to the library, read everything they can. A week later, collectively, we've read 94 articles, and all the students have read the summaries of those 94 articles posted by other students. And that becomes a much richer discussion than simply breaking down a couple articles that I assigned. Of course, this is all back to Parker Palmer's classic twist, right? It's not just an expert delivering content to the amateurs. This is a conversion to the point where all the students become knowers, co-knowers along with me, and we're sort of dancing around this subject together. Like I said, it expands outward, so we get students going out onto YouTube, expanding their networks. We produce things like, this is a Google Doc. This is day one of a massive project where we all took everything we learned an entire semester and tried to co-write a paper. And it took some time. It took us, in fact, 2 years of slaughtering through this project. But this is now being published by a major university press. And these are undergrads, you know, so that can be pretty remarkable. I know we want to have time for discussion, so all in there. That's a picture of my crew there that got their paper published.
All right, thank you. I'm going to ask one question, and then I'll turn over the floor over to you for your questions. I'd like us to think in practical terms for a moment. I think that you've all made very, very eloquent cases for diversity and the potential and richness of collaboration tools. But in essence, who's going to pay for it all? As I said in my introductory remarks, IT has tried to get by enforcing some set of conformity because their resources, you could argue, are shrinking. They're losing staff and funds, not gaining it. You could also argue, for example, that not all faculty can do, Michael, what you do, you know, being facile with things like Yahoo Pipes. They'll need support if they're going to move into this space. How should that support responsibility happen, given where we are right now?
Well, I'll give it a try. The starting point for this is to realize that we're already spending a tremendous amount of money on the kind of support that we're providing. Nobody knows exactly how much is being spent on learning management systems, I'm pretty confident. But it is safe to say that at Illinois we're spending more than well over $1 million a year on learning management systems. We don't just run one centrally, but we also run instances in several different of the colleges. And the sum total of all that cost is an enormous amount of money. If it were possible to make that fungible and to make that spendable by faculty on a discretionary basis, you could buy any number of services from the cloud at the kind of prices that faculty pay. So there is money there to do this if we choose to do it. And I think it is an empirical question as to whether an approach where people adopt and acquire individually is cheaper or costlier than the other kind of strategy. I myself believe it might be cheaper to let faculty acquire services one by one from the cloud. The other part of this, having concerns about whether faculty will be able to make good choices. Right now, faculty certainly need a tremendous amount of support in order to use things like Moodle, Blackboard, and the other things that we commonly support centrally. That's because those environments are artificial for us. Whereas the things that we use for our research in our own work, or the things that would be used in the professions that are associated with our disciplines, are naturalized competence. If people were able to choose those, the support needs would change in ways that we can't even begin to predict. Okay, I'm going on too long, but go ahead.
Well, I agree with you on that. And I would also say that it maybe isn't just about support. I'd like to see central IT, or whatever you might want to call it, move also into a role of inspiring people. And that's another, I mean, and I don't know that this has to cost money. I mean, everything that I showed was free for use. But somebody in central IT, and it's not a lot of work that needs to be done, but somebody in central IT needs to simply start bringing faculty together, sort of be a point person who's sort of monitoring what all the innovations are around the campus, and then bring those people together for things like speed dating or whatever it might be that can help spread those ideas. Essentially start creating community around these types of innovations.
Jim, I obviously think all the time about the funding question from a campus standpoint. And so I will, first of all, agree with the sort of theme that's going on here. We spend a lot of money on this already. And one of the things I believe and that we're seeing is that there actually are ways to tap into that money that's being spent, but still maintain and actually support this diversity. So that's actually the theme I was trying to present. But rather than, I guess I'm not going all the way to getting rid of the our learning management system, but what we've done is basically say, you know, ask where does it fit in, who's using it, what functionality makes sense there, how do we fund that? But let's also draw upon the campus overall. So we're seeing a lot of this has to do, just like what Sally and Mike are saying. There's a lot of tools being out there. Let's expose them. You know, let's understand what are working well. Let's let the community sort some of these kinds of things out. They are very smart people out there, and if the central IT gets into this role of bringing the community together, brokering these kinds of discussions, there's actually a lot to be gained from that. That does not cost very much. And I do want to emphasize too that at least we're finding with some substantial exercises now, these RFP processes, these contests, as I was mentioning very briefly, are really good ways to draw these things out, as well as manage the resources in very, very positive ways, in ways that the campus responds to in a positive way. So it's all the same theme, but I agree with the principle that there's a lot of money out there, and there's some ways to draw on how it's being invested right now in better ways.
Can I follow up?
Yes,
very,
please
very
do.
Briefly? One of the things that that I think will happen if we try to make a break with the current sort of conventional wisdom and shape a new strategy is we'll naturally move toward an organization in which the technical staff are supporting people rather than services. And I know that that's part of what you've been describing, is the going out and exposing what people are using and then attempting to make that part of a set of possibilities for the whole. So making the user, the faculty member and the student, the center of the network of resources and support staff helping people find what they need, rather than the technical staff running a service and then going out and looking for the customers for it. It's two totally different ways of organizing support.
All right. Veronica, do we have a question from IdeaScale?
Yeah, we do. Somebody asks, this question is directed at Mike, but maybe the others could chime in as well. When you're essentially crowdsourcing assignments, as has been described, do you feel that allows for the same level of deeper learning as when you select the assignments or readings yourself?
Yeah, and I have all kinds of reasons for saying that. One is that I've had several students say to me, because of that particular assignment, that they're reading more than ever and that they're reading books that they would have never read before. It allows them to, on the one hand, I guess it can look like you're sort of skimming over the surface of things because you're reading 94 summaries, but instead what's happening is that students are discovering all kinds of materials and then doing deep dives into specific materials throughout the semester. So definitely, I think it's a very rich experience for the students.
All right, we have a question from the floor.
So, Michael, help me out here. Today you're quoted in the Chronicle as questioning the tools and their ability to connect with your students, primarily because your colleagues aren't able to replicate the kind of connection that you do. And then, Sally, you are saying that the tools matter in terms of the kinds of digital collaboration. I would just follow up on a comment or a question to you, Sally. You're paying $1 million at Illinois for your LMS. What are you paying for your SIS?
For what?
For your student integration system or your HR system.
Oh.
We've allowed ourselves to be put into a teaching and learning box in the IT infrastructure. And it always amazes me how much we complain about what our LMS costs, but we never take a look at the overall IT infrastructure for security, enterprise, HR, finance. You know, our core mission is teaching and learning, but you'd never know it by looking at the IT budget. And it just amazes me.
So, any comment?
So it's sort of a comment or question to both of you, and I'll take my answer up this line.
Shall I go first?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Well, first, tremendous justice in what you're saying, and I agree. I agree that our expenditure doesn't really reflect how we should be valuing different activities. I'd be the first to say that. But my point was that there's money there, and our question is how we can best use it. What we spend on IT for instruction is, of course, a small fraction of all that we spend on instruction. But it's definitely the case that I don't think we spend enough on support for instruction. Everybody who in this room who has worked for me will know that I believe that. But no matter how much it is, we have choices about how we spend it. And some of our ways of spending are going to tend to be better for the outcomes we want than other ways of spending. Okay, so the more interesting things, though, are yours.
Just to clarify that, so the article in the Chronicle is called "A Text Happy Professor Reboots" or something like that. And what it was Jeffrey Young from the Chronicle called me. He was doing he wants to do a presentation on the end of lectures. And I think he wanted me for the soundbite who would say, yeah, end of lectures. And instead, I surprised him by saying, no, some lectures are actually pretty good because they fit in with the broader ecosystem of a university. Like, they can create all kinds of stimulating internal conversations and all that kind of stuff. So I'm not actually rebooting so much. And as you can see, like, I still very much believe in media literacy, which is why I include these types of things in my classes. And that said, back to where we're going with all of this is, you know, you think about what else you could provide as central IT. One of the things that is almost never provided is really high quality web space for free to any faculty or student. So they can install their own WordPress, their own Joomla or Zoops or Drupal or whatever they want to do. And it's all one click installation, and then they can create whatever they want out of that space. They can create new types of collaboration spaces for their students or for themselves. And that's not provided, or if it is, it's very rarely provided. And I've pushed a bit on my own campus for this. And the general thought from central IT is that that would be chaos, that anarchy was actually the word that was used. And I think, you know, I think, Jim, you mentioned sort of the potentials of chaos, right? I mean, the chaos can actually be a good thing, especially when you're talking about learning and trying to sort of feel our way through these new possibilities for collaboration. So, and you talk about low cost. There's already, if you go department by department around our campus, there's probably over $1,000 spent on web space off campus by each department unit, and that's because the campus is not providing that for us. So we're doing it anyway, and we're going off campus to get it, and we're all paying in our own little increments. We could instead have virtual servers at a fraction of the cost running the same thing through central IT, but it's not happening due to various policy issues and things like that, a lot of the things that we're discussing here.
Jim, did you have any comment? Do you want to add anything to that?
I was trying to decide how to respond, since I'm kind of representing the other side, and I'm trying to be a little careful here because I spent so much time on the other side, but so is Sally. But the bottom line is I agree with all the points. That's actually the whole reason for this position now, which is to kind of break away from those administrative systems, if you will, and try to get the balance back in place. So literally what I'm trying to do is to aggregate these little costs, if you will, into something that's very meaningful to the campus, and at the same time, try to get funding moving towards the research and education where it really needs to be. We're in fact trying to do exactly this. We call it digital presence for the faculty, trying to put together a resource that faculty can load and play on the web much, much easier than all these distributed ways that it's done right now. So there's a whole variety of those things, but the principle here is that this really needs to happen, and there's a lot of expertise and capability out there that we need to tap into. So the notion of embrace the chaos, or whatever we want to call it, I think is extremely important, and that's what we're trying to tackle.
All right, next question from the floor, please.
Yes, In order to support the multiplicity of tools in the social networking, the adaptability and the disruptive change, it seems like implicit in that is moving away from or breaking open the monolithic control of maybe a single LMS or whatever it is that's reigning. To do that implies to me that you need some other way to manage an understanding of classes so that you can restrict content to classes, and then you can choose to go beyond that restriction to a more open sphere. That means a middleware that's independent of the learning management framework. And isn't that some place where IT resource might be played? Or did you not get the question?
Yeah. What? Yeah. What was that?
I'm not sure I got the question.
You did. Okay. One of the questions was, how shall we allocate IT resource in the kind of environments that you describe? And a suggestion was, well, you can focus the IT support on the instructors rather than being more service focused. And that kind of makes sense. But I see another burden for IT in the kind of environments that you describe, and I guess I'd like your impressions about my sense.
Right.
That is, isn't there a need to provide a comprehensive learning framework that doesn't constrain instructors and students to a single monolithic environment?
Okay. I thought I was following along pretty well here. At least for me, I would say no. A comprehensive framework, we can safely do without that. There are probably tools that we do need to assist a very wide range of instructors, and those would be gradebook with some sort of secure method for communicating grades to students, and a roster tool that allows you to see who's in your class. But many of us want not to contain the classroom experience, but to open it to the world. So we want to know who's going to get a grade in the class, but we also want a lot of other people to be able to be there in the classroom. So the things that we need to do to try to cope with the chaos fall into that meta-management category, and that means, for example, having some kind of a method built into your business systems to capture large numbers of purchases of the same thing. We'd like, the same way we do with things like software purchases right now, to try to decide when it's appropriate to get a site license rather than let everybody buy one contract at a time. If we have a method of purchasing that allows every faculty member to make adoption and acquisition decisions on their own, we also have a method, a meta-management method, for detecting when there are, broad adoptions of things that might allow us to get economies of scale by writing a contract for the thing. And a nice thing about that kind of meta-management strategy is that it allows us to operate either at the campus scale or at a consortium scale. So we're just as well off using, for example, services that can be brokered through something like Internet2 or EDUCAUSE as we are using services that aggregate to a particular campus level. Okay, that's my take on that, but others probably have a take too.
I can. At least I've been speaking kind of generalities. I don't know if this answers the question, so I'll notch down in specifics. So, from a platform standpoint, we at Moodle site, we spend a good deal of money on that, but we're seeing a great deal of use of it and the ability to build the functionality out in useful ways for a number of faculty, and we're letting that be driven by the faculty. And the funding goes in is by what is needed there, but we're not saying that's the only platform, and in fact our theater, film, and television department is actually wanting to use they have developed a different platform that we are incorporating for a different use, a different style, a different kind of collaboration mediation. And so we're We're open to absorbing those kinds of things. When we get to content-rich tools, we have several that are coming out that have come through this RFP process. An example is HyperCities, you know, where you overlay maps in time, and we can use that for multiple courses. That's come through an RFP process. Those are expensive, and so those actually have to sort out in terms of where there's some kind of critical mass for using them. And then this community stuff is where you get into a lot of low-cost stuff because there's so many different tools that are being used in so many different contexts. If we can expose those, we can get a lot of coverage, you know, bringing those kinds of things forward. So there's a whole range of these things. Some are very expensive, some are not, that we're trying to manage in different ways and getting the money to take them forward. So sort of that gets at, at least illustrates some things against that question.
Can I follow up? The question I follow up with is, I'm not advocating for a single LMS as, you know, a framework that's one thing. But assuming the scenario that you're providing on your campus, do you want a single authentication framework, a single group management framework, so you can protect the FERPA when you need to, and instructors can go to the content management system of their choice and still feel comfortable that they're not going to be exposed with policy problems?
Yeah, the answer to that, I call it that infrastructure, and the answer to that is yes. That's a single framework.
And that actually is now becoming more possible, even on the free tools that I'm using. I guess we're lucky enough at K-State where we actually have our homegrown LMS, which means we have a whole bunch of developers right there in town. And they are aware of this type of integration or integration challenge, right? You're using all these free tools. And one of the things they're working on is just creating a single sign-on that will still work across all these different tools, and actually some of the data can actually be drawn in from these different places as well. And that's getting easier and easier given the different types of identification, authentication systems now available.
Okay, let me ask just one more question. You have 30 seconds for reply. I just want to get your thoughts because I think this is a really key question. I think this has been a very, very fruitful and engaging conversation. But given the elements like the Pearson announcement where they have a LMS essentially that faculty can just pop their course in, so the faculty can say, I don't need the campus LMS anymore. So kind of riffing off this question, do we really need to rethink what it means to provide an academic technology framework or infrastructure given where we are now? Sally?
Well, struggling for something more to say about this because I've already said no. We don't need a campus-level framework that is standard for the campus. We probably do need some level of academic planning that rises above the level of individual courses. That's inherent. Oh, I'm using up too much.
No, keep going. You're fine.
But that's inherent in the idea that across many courses, people should have many experiences that force them to learn that there are ways of doing things that aren't the ways that they've done it in the past. But I am not sure that I'd want to associate that with a technology framework. I think I'd want to associate that with a curriculum framework.
Mike, want to respond or just any last comment?
I would just say that I see us very much like at a crossroads of our time, and that crossroads is that either this stuff in the air, which is the digital artifacts of 2 billion people collaborating and connecting and all that, it is either going to be the world's most amazing collaboration and creativity machine ever, or it's going to be the world's most amazing distraction device. And central IT, I think, if anybody on campus has a role in inspiring us to make it a collaboration machine, it should be central IT. And so maybe a CIO shouldn't be a chief information officer, but a chief inspiration officer.
Interesting. Jim, any last comment?
So I guess I hit the middle ground on this. I think there's a set of things that are useful to be set in place. So we talk about identity management. It could be grades. It could be some things that are just make things more efficient. But when you get to the actual tools, the collaboration tools, what's used in the class, what the faculty want to use, then I think it needs to spread out dramatically and draw in all these kinds of things. So to me, it's the environment that brings those two kinds of things together. And that to me is where we're trying to mix and match and find the sweet spot on these kinds of things going forward.
Well, Jim Davis, Mike Wesch, Sally Jackson, thank you so much. Please join with me in thanking our panelists today.